Here's your Uncle Don presenting the 338th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Just 2.5 weeks until Christmas, and CFUR will be shut down for a week. Then my wife and I are off on a 3-week holiday in the Virgin Islands. As you settle back down to the grind of school, work, or job hunting, think of our sailing on the rented catamaran from island to island, swimming, snorkeling, and soaking up sun. Life as a retired couple is rough, but someone has to do it. British Columbia's new Democrats have now held their convention. I eagerly await the platform upon which they will build their next campaign against Campbell's Liberals. Wouldn't it be a pleasant change if this were to be the only party in Canada to come clean on what they would do in power? There isn't a single party that will come clean in what they plan for us. All claim that they will maintain social programs, continue our war against Afghanistan in some form, refrain from raising taxes, and reduce debt. These goals, when put forward by knowledgeable politicians, form a disingenuous package. To pull ourselves out of the debt hole, we'll have to reduce spending or increase income. The only other option would be the eventual defaulting on sovereign debt. Harper claims we'll return to budget surpluses through natural growth, but no economists believe this bit of Tinkerbell thinking. Since the days of Ronald Reagan, conservatives on both sides of the border have been transparent in their aim of increasing debt through profligate spending and tax cuts. This debt has had the dual functions of providing a safe haven for the savings of their supporters, while forcing citizens to accept eventual cuts in social programs to pay interest on that debt. In this respect, piling on debt is an indirect way for them to siphon money from the needy to the greedy. My conception of an ideal election campaign would have the Conservatives, both provincial and federal, admit their goals. See if Canadians vote for politicians who confess that they intend to reduce taxes on wealth and income while concurrently cutting spending on our medical system, infrastructure, justice, and other foundations of a civilized society. Privatize, privatize, privatize until there's nothing left of government functions but the police, courts, and military. See if that fits the image citizens have of their future society. Then let those dreaded socialists put forth candidates who will tell the truth in what it will take to restore society, which used to be the envy of the world. Yes, taxes will have to increase, perhaps back to levels not seen since the last World War. Living standards will have to be trimmed. To get revenues and expenditures back in line with a healthy surplus to retire debt will require sacrifices by those with means. A trickle-down theory promoting accumulation of vast fortunes with the promise of prosperity will find its way down to the poor has been proven to be merely a rationalization of the greedy. Wealth accumulated at the top stagnates and is eventually passed on to those whose only claim of it is through bloodlines. Socialists need to restore balance through trickle-up policies. It's been amply demonstrated that money directed to the bottom finds its way back to the top. The poor don't stash their money in bonds or offshore bank accounts. They spend it on such things as food, clothing, and shelter. And yes, they will also blow it on junk food, alcohol, and tobacco, but those expenditures feed the corporations owned by wealthy folk. It's been forgotten by self-styled conservatives that a major function of democratic government is to keep money flowing. Moving money is taxed and supports that government. Stagnant money is a symbol of imbalance. When I studied economics in the 60s, it was taken for granted that redistribution of money was a legitimate and necessary function of government. The reactionary revolution of the 70s and beyond seems to have overlooked this. In any case, it would be a breath of fresh air if political parties came clean on what would be necessary to bring Canada's economy and society back into balance. Maybe then we could vote based on policies rather than fabricated personalities and attack advertising. Guess what the natural gas industry is telling the government of Alberta? Royalty rates must be reduced in order to provide the incentives to continue drilling. If the government fails to drop its take, production and exploration will fail, taking public revenues with them. Reduce revenues to avoid a reduction in revenues. Right. Here's another example of the failings of globalization. With gas traded internationally, a cut in tax on the resource in the U.S. must be echoed in Canada lest production shift south, and of course that works the other way. The upshot is that governments on either side earn less on their public resources. Another thing of which we can be sure, when supplies are constricted by increasing consumption, producers will lobby against any restoration of royalties. When all is said and done, every jurisdiction should be increasing royalties and taxes to discourage production and export of precious resources. Canadians relying on future supplies of gas to heat their homes, not to mention that used for generating electricity and as feedstock for plastics. We should not be encouraging the frantic use or export of this wasting resource. Here again, we're squandering something our children and grandchildren will need for survival. Someday those descendants will curse us for a profligacy. All eyes are on escalation of the war against Afghanistan. How many soldiers will be necessary to win the war? What would constitute winning? How could NATO exit the country in an orderly fashion? It's assumed that the war against Iraq serves as an example of successful intervention. About $800 billion has been spent to eradicate the legacy of Saddam Hussein, replacing it with a Western-style freedom and democracy. Considering the deterioration of freedoms in countries such as, for instance, Canada, they might have set the bar too low for Iraq. A Western-styled court in the new Iraq has fined the Guardian newspaper for reporting criticism of Nouri al-Maliki, the country's prime minister. This was not criticism itself, but merely the quoting of intelligence officials as saying that the PM was becoming increasingly authoritarian. Reporters, domestic and foreign, say that this decision has a chilling effect. They must now be very careful of what they say about Iraq's government. It's assumed that the court was influenced by al-Maliki, demonstrating that Iraq's judicial system is not independent. The British official who served as Director of Operations and Infrastructure of the provincial government after Hussein was ousted proclaimed, quote, "Freedom from tyranny and the freedom of speech which underpins it was the reason so many people, Iraqi and others, tried so hard and suffered so much after Saddam was removed in 2003. Will the United States and other former members of the Coalition of the Willing force their stepchild government of Iraq to loosen authoritarian control over press freedoms? If not, might that validate the charge that this war was not to free Iraqis from tyranny, but to free the oil reserves for foreign exploitation? Contrary to what Canadians believe our government has promised, we will not be pulling our soldiers home from Afghanistan in 2011. Their role will be changed from waging aggressive war to training and security. This will not be withdrawal, but relabeling. Canadian soldiers have been occupying Afghanistan for 8 years so far. In that time, they've endeavored to train local candidates to become soldiers. 8 years. When I signed up for the U.S. Army, I was subjected to a week of processing leading to 8 weeks of basic training, after which I was declared a raw but adequate soldier. 8 weeks. Supposedly, it's been difficult to process and train Afghan recruits. Most are illiterate and undisciplined. But 8 years of efforts and they're still not an army worthy of the name? In that time, every recruit could have been put through elementary school as well as being given serious training in arms. Will another couple of years accomplish what eight have not? Maybe this extension of Canadian occupation is in anticipation of being able to hand responsibility to a subsequent Canadian administration, leaving the entire mess in their hands. It worked for George Wanker Bush when he dumped his share of the war into the lap of Obama to deal with, and for which he will take the blame for failure. But Obama has done it now. He's lost the support of Uncle Don, and I would suppose the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. He's forfeited any claim to being saddled with Bush's Afghan war. He's adopted it, and he seems to have added Pakistan to the mix. I doubt that Norwegians are doing much bragging about their choice of recipient for their peace prize in light of his sending another 30,000 American soldiers into the quagmire of the AFPAC theater, as the military calls it. If his army can't defeat the Taliban in battle, will they smother them with sheer numbers? NATO's troop numbers are now comparable to those of the Soviets before they were forced out of Afghanistan. I shiver when considering the close parallel between Obama's surges and the Johnson-Nixon escalations. Both were intended, at each step of the way, to be just what was needed to turn the tide of war. Upward and upward until there were 500,000 in Vietnam, and they were still defeated. How many will Obama inflict on Afghanistan before they admit failure? The greatest danger to NATO now could be success. With ever more thousands of soldiers in the country, they could drive Taliban fighters over the eastern border to Pakistan, where they're already destabilizing the country. That's just what NATO needs, a civil war in a nuclear-armed country. Michael Ignatieff has joined Harper in my bad graces. It's increasingly clear that Canadians have little choice between the two, as their policies are congruent. The final straw was Iggy's announcement that he supported legislation enabling the introduction of the HST into Ontario and British Columbia. He not only acquiesced to this new tax, but forced his caucus to vote for it. As our unlamented former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney would have said, "You had a choice, sir." He could have either curried the favor of the premiers of our respective provinces or satisfied the majority of citizens who opposed the HST. There was a clear division here. He declared that he would listen to demands of his Liberal premiers over the wishes of ordinary consumers who will bear the brunt of the tax. But the so-called Liberal administration of Gordon Campbell is Liberal in nothing but name. He dances to Harper's tune and would be called conservative if the name hadn't been co-opted by another band of provincial brigands. BC's beloved premier proudly stated that tax changes will benefit business to the tune of almost $2 billion a year, while saddling consumers with at least that much. He hauls out the threadbare trickle-down theory to explain that how lowering taxes for corporations will cause an explosion of investment in our province, bringing jobs and prosperity to all. Bullshit. We've heard this malarkey before. It was nonsense then, and it's nonsense now. This tax shift is a gift to Liberal Party supporters. What will Canadians face in the next federal election? Liberals and Conservatives are in bed together as corporate stooges. The Bloc is an option only in Quebec, while New Democrats and Greens haven't a clue what they represent. Dark days for citizens of Canada. Others love it. Hoard it, fight for it, die for it. I speak of that durable heavy metal, gold. When Europeans discovered that natives of the Americas used gold for ornamentation, they enslaved these poor devils in their mines to dig the metal. They tortured and killed for gold to ship back east. When gold was discovered in the Klondike, men from across the world flocked to that rugged land, suffering unbelievable hardships in their quest for gold. Anywhere the metal has been discovered, it triggered the greed and lust for gold's instant wealth. Gold is a curse. I dislike the metal, avoiding except for a slender band holding one of my fingers hostage. I worked in a gold mine in Australia. It never escaped my mind what a foolish enterprise this was. Every day, miners ventured underground in dangerous conditions to extract the ore yielding gold. In the refining process, toxic waste was spread across the land. The finished product was cast into bars, and guess what? It was reburied in heavily guarded vaults. There's currently a rush to buy gold as a store of value. Speculators show their distrust of paper money, threatening to lose buying power as markets are flooded with it to stimulate the economy. Since fiat money is only valuable to the extent that it is scarce, there's good reason to believe that a bubble of inflation is around the corner. Gold has the advantage that, as opposed to paper and electronic money, they aren't making the stuff anymore. Alchemists tried for centuries to find the Philosopher's Stone capable of turning base metals into gold. Pity they never found it, or we'd be using the stuff for doorknobs and not thinking of it any more than we do iron. Gold as an industrial product has limited use. Minute amounts appear in electronics and medicines, but the bulk of gold, that not hidden in vaults or pressed into coins, goes into jewelry. It's pretty, doesn't tarnish, but it's heavy. Other materials would be more practical, but wouldn't have the advantages of enticing envy and being perceived as a store of value. I prefer stainless steel. Gold has limited value in itself, but its worth is only what others value it. Speculators masquerading as investors are buying binge for gold. The price has been driven to over $1,100 an ounce. It's being hoarded in medallions of various weights, sold as coins, but never intended to be used in trade. It's cast into bars to be stored, often in anticipation of an economic collapse. It's traded by the ton. India recently bought 200 tons of gold from the International Monetary Fund to augment its government reserves. Much of the increase of gold price is in anticipation that governments like India will drive demand by moving their reserves from the American dollar. Hoarded gold earns no dividends. Hoarding of gold, as well as its sister metals, silver and platinum, is solely for the prospect of capital gains. Precious metals are not only dead as investments, but it costs money to keep and protect them. A few coins or bars can be stashed in a safe at home or in a safe deposit box. When standard 100 or 400 ounce bars are hoarded, the secure services of a commercial operation, like the vaults of HSBC Incorporated, are required, for a fee, of course. Such was the rush to accumulate gold that vaults are overflowing. HSBC told smallholders that they will no longer keep their coins and bars. Secure space is required by the biggies. People like the man in Wisconsin who owns a mere 50 100-ounce bars of silver must vacate its vaults. I know everyone will sympathize with logistic problems facing owners of precious metal stashes, which must be moved. Fleets of armored cars are required amidst massive security operations. Where they will go is a matter of speculation due to the protection required. There's some out there willing to go to great extremes in acquiring the gold of others, just like in the good old days. As for me, I'd welcome the discovery of a cheap means of creating gold by manipulating protons, neutrons, and electrons of some common element. Suddenly, the services of storage companies would not be needed to protect that precious metal. It might then fall in price below that of copper, a metal that is truly useful. Yes, I wouldn't mind having golden doorknobs. They'd be a constant reminder of the cupidity and stupidity of human beings. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. One of my avocations is battling bureaucracies, public and corporate. Although my longest was for 7 years with the American government in a campaign to shed my citizenship, there have been many others. A favorite was my battle against the British Columbia Telephone Company, an entity now merged into TELUS. Shortly after my arrival in BC, I applied for a telephone. I requested that my address be omitted from the coming telephone directory. The company refused. Why? Their first reply was that addresses are included to distinguish between those with similar surnames. I explained that no one else in town shared my last name, so the argument was specious. BCTEL then told me that addresses were included as a courtesy to Canada Post in directing mail. I agreed that this was a fine idea. They could use my post office box number in the book. They refused. The company then explained that inclusion of addresses was common practice for phone companies across North America. I referred them to the previous year's book issued by the company in Oakland, California, where they would find my name, sans address. Their last bastion of defense was that inclusion of addresses was company policy. My final step was to write a letter to the chairman of General Telephone in New York, the parent corporation of BCTEL. Eventually, I received a letter from the local company saying they were begrudgingly granting my request. When the next book was published, I eagerly sought my name, and damn it, there it was with my address again. More letters were exchanged, and finally there arrived a book with my name and no more. I always feel a bit let down when a battle is won and the war is over. The joy is largely in the battle. When engaging in a contest with a bureaucracy or business, I always start with a letter to a local individual, preferably by name or position. I request a written reply so I'll have a paper trail if my problem is not resolved. I won't be put off with a telephone call, and I don't reveal my email. A negative reply requires another missive addressed to a higher level. When I've exhausted local avenues, I go for a corporate parent, or in the case of government, a politician. Confronting corporations is more fun than governments, as they're more conscious of public relations. For everyone who complains about a practice or product, they know there are dozens who are also bothered, but who are silent. Governments are too adept at burying a complaint or sending the complainant around a bureaucratic maze of buck passing until an individual's strength is spent. When writing to anyone, there are two little characters to be included at the bottom, CC. If the recipient knows or believes that copies of my complaint are going to others, he or she can be aware that it cannot be bottled up without the knowledge of someone else. If I want to be sneaky, I add below my CCs a BCC, indicating that blind copies have been sent to undisclosed persons, or, horror of horrors, the press. My battles so far have a good record of success, although I've been defeated in some, either abandoning them or making an end run. In one case, I could not elicit a response from a local MLA to my several letters. His staff refused to give me his email address. I retaliated by setting in motion a recall campaign of which I was the sole supporter. I never collected signatures or went further, but the existence of a pending recall tied him in knots until the time the limit expired. He never forgave me, but perhaps it was a lesson to him and others that they ignore their constituents at their peril. Here in British Columbia, we have the Financial Accountability Act, requiring that those who approved expenditures and those authorizing payment to be separate individuals. This prevents a single person conspiring with a supplier to engage in fraudulent transactions at public expense. It doesn't eliminate the problem, but it makes fraud more difficult. There'll always be those using positions of authority to raid the public purse, and the guilty are not always members of Parliament. On the federal level, Treasury guidelines require that any contract for more than $10,000 must be publicly disclosed. The current federal government has decided that this does not apply to military contractors or mercenaries if revelation could endanger their safety. There's an odor to this decision, as it is easily used as a cover for partisan spending. Ideally, government contracts are put out to competitive bidding. But this doesn't apply to senior officers in the field of the Afghan war. They've been authorized to approve, on their own, expenditures of up to $1 million. These are not reported to the public. Our funds have been spent locally for mercenary guardians and gifts, like cell phone cards and Viagra tablets for local officials. One day we'll hear more about these inordinate powers granted to spend the Canadian public's money, but for now, all is covered in secrecy for reasons of national security. The Swiss public, in their wisdom, approved a referendum outlawing the building of any more minarets in their country. Their arguments are many and varied, but all deny that this represents any kind of discrimination against their Muslim citizens. Methinks they doth protest too much. Believe that denial, and you will still be putting fallen teeth under your pillow. In Istanbul, the city's many minarets enhance the beauty of the place, but maybe the Swiss are right in that they don't fit in with the traditional image of the pastel shuttered houses, expensive watches, and cuckoo clocks. But why didn't they level the playing field and include church steeples in their prohibition? Aren't they as intrusive in a skyline as any minaret? All of my undergraduate economics courses made a simple, basic assumption. It was clear, concise, and wrong. They assumed that humans are driven principally by a desire to maximize wealth. By elimination of other human desires, lusts, and failings, equations can be derived and theories developed. This fallacy forms the basis of rationalizations for globalization. It's assumed that if goods and services are freely traded around the world, total wealth would be maximized. This takes no account of any desirable for national self-sufficiency. It ignores the environment as an externality. Love and care for family, community, and nation are irrelevant. Politics is thought to be a child of the economy, not the other way around. When debt is used to finance consumption, everyone is assumed to be better off with more shiny stuff or services. Little thought is given to the distribution of that wealth. Don't worry about debts, as they'll be taken care of in a future year or be the problem of another generation. Some people are beginning to recognize that humans have deeper drives than the single-minded pursuit of wealth. We need love, recreation, prestige, and stimulation, physical and mental, often in the sacrifice of wealth. Economics must recognize that psychology is as much a driver of human actions as pure hedonism. I consider myself an example of a post-economic individual. I've often said that money is like toilet paper and that it's not important until it runs out. I don't aspire to become a billionaire. What in the world would a person do with such wealth that could be constructive? I husband what I have to the extent that I feel confident that my family will be able to maintain a modest standard of comfort now and in the future. Any surplus to those needs can be given away as far as I'm concerned, and no, applications for grants are not being accepted at this time. I immigrated to Canada in 1975, leaving California for a similar job here at lower pay. As a rough calculation, living expenses here were about twice those that I left. Down there, I lived in a two-bedroom duplex for $85 a month. Here, I paid almost that much for a furnished basement room. Down there, I could buy lunch for a dollar. Here I couldn't get a decent meal for several times that. Before I left Oakland, I went out with friends and bought a huge pizza. The next week, I took Canadian friends out for a similar pizza and paid more than twice as much, paying for it in Canadian dollars, trading at $1.02 U.S. I gave away a house full of furniture, coming here with what I could carry in and on my Volkswagen. I found that used stuff here cost more than new down there. Passable American beer in a supermarket was going for $2.99 a case of 24. Here it was $3.45 for a dozen. No, I'm not advertising the virtues of California, and I don't recommend that anyone move there, especially now that they're in financial crisis. Oakland, where I lived, had serious disadvantages that were non-monetary. From my living room, it was not uncommon to hear gunfire at night. I lived in a strip that was largely Oriental, separating the white section from the black ghetto. Cops were reluctant to enter the ghetto at night for fear of ambushes. One night, some worthy citizen shot down a police helicopter that annoyed him. At this time, the Black Panthers were fighting back against brutal oppression by a white police force, largely recruited from the Deep South. The Hells Angels, which started in our city, were becoming a force to be reckoned with in the underworld. One night, we heard screaming from outside our house. We rushed out to find a Chinese woman who had been mugged on our doorstep. We brought her in and called the police. Shortly after a cop arrived to question us, another cop appeared at the door with his gun drawn. The first officer had failed to answer his radio, and the assumption was that he was down. And, of course, politics of the Nixon regime were totally repugnant. Canada offered a peaceful, friendly environment which beckoned with much more rewarding advantages than a financial ones offset by living south of the border. It's a real pity that Canada's turning into a carbon copy of the States. Congratulations to the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. He ordered the trial of those alleged conspirators responsible for the creation of the World Trade Crater, as well as a hole in the Pentagon building and a newly plowed field in Pennsylvania, to be held in a civilian court in New York. If the suspects were tried, as first proposed by military tribunal, critics would have rightly called it a kangaroo court with a fixed verdict. Holder would be wise not to seek the death penalty in case of convictions. There are two solid reasons for this. Killing those men would fulfill their wish of becoming martyrs in the eyes of followers. Surely this would provoke a wave of retaliatory terror acts, perhaps again on U.S. soil. But the second reason for seeking life sentences is more persuasive. Under New York law, close relatives of murder victims are entitled to witness the perpetrator's execution. If each of those killed in the World Trade Center had an average of four relatives wishing to see this spectacle, there would need to be seating for 12,000 people, and there's not a courtroom this side of Dubai with that many chairs. Hire a stadium? Images of Romans feeding Christians to the lions come to mind. No, don't go for the gold on this one. Life sentences would see those convicted disappear into the obscurity of America's vast prison complex. This concludes the 338th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Somerset Maugham's words of wisdom are worth quoting here. He's reputed to have said, "From the earliest times the old have rubbed it into the young that they are wiser than they, and before the young had discovered what nonsense this was, they were old too, and it profited them to carry on the imposture."